Thank you very much, and good morning again to everyone. So I'm very happy today to talk about spinning conformal bootstrap in four dimensions. So here's the overview of my talk. I will start first with the motivation. Why are we interested in studying spinning correlators in four dimensions, and what is our plans and the global goal? And then the rest of the talk will be based on the paper written with Petr Kravchuk, Marco Sirona, and Alessandro Vicky, where we implemented for the first time a spinning bootstrap in four dimensions of four Weyl fermions. Basically, we bootstrap in this correlator. So I will start with the technical setup. I will show you how the crossing equations are constructed and how we can decompose them into conformal blocks and the OP coefficients. Then I'll talk about the rational approximation of conform blocks needed for performing numerics for the spinning blocks. Then I'll present you numerical bounds. So you will see that all these bounds, they have a striking feature. There will be disconnected jumps on them. And I will discuss the origin of these jumps in the last section, which I refer to as the fake primary effect. So let's start with the motivation. I don't need this. So if this is my energy scale in four dimensions, we have very nicely defined gauge theories described by gauge Lagrangian in the UV, gauge invariant Lagrangian. And for some of them, under the normalization group flow, they basically end up in a fixed point in the infrared. And this fixed point is described by CFT. We know that these CFTs exist. We have evidence from the Bang-Zaks weakly coupled construction. We also have a lot of studies on the lattice. However, when the CFT is very strongly coupled, they struggle to converge the numerics, and they fail to extract really the spectrum of the CFT. Normally, they provide data for one or two operators only. So new methods like conformal bootstrap would be very welcome to try to address this problem. So I'll give two examples just of gauge theories we might want to look at. The standard QCD, which is based on the SUN gauge group, and two Weyl fermions psi and chi, which are charged transforming under fundamental and anti-fundamental representation. And there are multiple copies of them, so I'll denote them by the index I and j, and ij goes from 1 to nf. It is required they have the same number of them to cancel gauge anomalies. However, the global group is a bit complicated in this setup. It will be SUN flavor cross SUN flavor cross U1. A bit easier gauge theory, I would refer to it as a second example, I call it AQCD, is the theory based again on the SUN gauge group and only one type of Weyl fermions transforming in the joint representation of the gauge group. So then the I goes from 1 to NF and the global group is SUNF. So for instance, these theories is the perfect candidate for studying using numerical bootstrap because the global group is quite simple. And so the best correlator we can think of to study would be a correlator of four currents for this global group. Which is a correlator of non-abelian current. So Why do we like to do it? Because when we bootstrap, we would like to specify what kind of gauge theory we really try to address. And one thing is the global group remains the same. So by studying this correlator, I literally inject the structure of the global group. This is one reason in a systematic way, global group. The second reason are the global anomalies. In the UV, for a particular gauge theory, I can compute a global anomaly associated to the triangular diagram of the currents. And this coefficient, due to Toft arguments, will remain exactly the same in the IR. And it will enter in the three-point function of currents. This thing inside here as an OPE coefficient. So basically, I can specify using this correlator the global group and inject here the value of this anomaly to specify what theory I'm bootstrapping. So this is a big goal, but we first have to learn how to do bootstrap in with spinning correlators. And the obvious candidates we can address first are a correlator of fermions. Then we can also address the correlator of for a billion currents to start with, and then the correlator of the stress tensor. To give you an order of magnitude how difficult these things are, so for fermions, you will see a bit more in details. They will have roughly 7 equations. The abelian currents have roughly 7 equations. These guys have the stress tensors 25. And here, I will have 7, exactly as in the abelian case, plus the number of representations appearing here, adjoint times adjoint. There are 7. So it's order of 50. So basically, to do this thing is more complicated than to do the stress tensors in 4D. Okay. What is known?
Yeah, not the conformal window.
Now I don't remember details. They approximately know for what number of flavors and colors this happens. They debate normally approximately the very strong limit if it's conformal or not. But we're pretty certain that there are CFTs. However, we don't know the data.
Yeah, I also have a question. Why does the number of equations matter so much? You don't write these equations by hand anymore, I hope. So
no.
50 or 25, you just press the button and it generates the equation. So what's the problem?
Yeah, in a sense, you're right. However, it takes time to get to that point when you press the button. So you need to develop the technology to press the button. It's not. In the end, right, the final plot, when everything is ready, the plot is to press the button. But it took some time. Good. So this talk, I will be talking about four fermions. And see what obstacles. I'll try to show what obstacles were there.
These four fermions, this will be gauge invariant local operators. So what can they be in these theories? Do you have an idea?
Right. In these theories, it's hard to construct them. So they should be gauge invariant. And for instance, if this is the SU3 gauge group, this one, so I have an epsilon invariant epsilon tensor, IJK, and I can try to construct, for instance, 3 fermions, J. Okay, so it will be a very heavy operator. So in this case, you can contract them like psi with f mu nu, because they're both in the adjoint representation. And you can see, for instance, here the classical dimension will be 9.5, which is crazy. Here is a bit better. It's 5.5. I think. Yeah, no, it's 7.5. What is it? 2.75, yeah. If you consider gauge groups with, for instance, with scalar and fermions, then you can go as low as 5.5. So just to set up a little bit the notation, in four dimensions, a generic operator transforming the generic representation has two spin labels, L and L bar. They're both integer, and it depends on the position and two polarizations. So we define this object, index 3 object, as the one with L open undotted indices, L bar dotted indices, contracted with some auxiliary objects. So in this notation, while fermions transform the representation, spin representation 1,0 and 0,1. Currents, the representation 1,1. Let me remove this part as well. So we assume that there is a global U1 symmetry, global U1 symmetry, and that the wild fermions, this is the four-point function I would like to consider, wild fermions psi have the charge q, and their Dygert partners have the charge minus q. We also assume that q is non-zero. This allows me to consider only this type of correlators, because the total charge should be zero to preserve this symmetry. If I were to consider the case when q were zero, then I would be in the case of Majorana fermions. For instance, I would have formed the Majorana four-component object, psi psi dagger. But then, in this case, I would have had to consider also correlators of the form of four psi's or 3 psi and psi dagger. We don't want to do it. It's complicated. Our bounds still apply in this case. However, they will be suboptimal. Right. We also do not assume any parity or time reversal. Okay. So that's the problem. Now let me show what bootstrap equations do we get. Bootstrap equations or crossing equations. We have the S. First, we have how do you call them? Yeah, the ST equations. So. What I do, I take an OPE in the S channel, contracting first two operators, and then in the T channel. So what I would like here to do is now to bring this in the S channel configuration by anti-commuting fermions. So the points here are space-like separated. So the fermions anti-commute. For instance, I can bring this object here and this object here. There will be three anti-commutations, and the final equation I get in the full glory will be written like this. P2. I have three, so I get a minus. So this is one of the equations we'd like to study. However, I also have to consider the UT equation. Okay. So UT equation will have the form. The U contraction goes like this. And the T contraction is exactly as in the previous case. In this case, playing with anti-commutations, it's a bit more complicated, but basically, I can bring this equation to the following form, final form. I get minus sign again. So notice, in the ST equations, I always have an OP between psi daiga and psi, in both cases. In the second equation, I have an OP between psi and psi. So this equation really contains a different configuration, different information. Also notice that here I have, it's slightly different, the daiga stands here. Now, using, we can decompose our four-point functions in terms of tensor structures and the associated functions. And the four-point function of generic spin, Weyl fermions has six tensor structures, so I can write them. The form of this equation is some function of two variables, z and z bar, and the tensor structures. However, because we have identical fermions, using permutation, I can show that only four structures survive here. Also, due to CPT invariance, or equivalently complex conjugation with permutations, one can show that these functions are real. Now, what we can do, we can decompose these equations in terms of tensor structures, and the equations I get are the following. Decomposing the left-hand side, I get some function gi of z and z bar. I get some matrix ij, and exactly the same function, g. However, the permutation 1 and 3 gives me a very simple operation on z and z bar. So I get 1 minus z, 1 minus z bar. The same here. This is a different four-point function, so I parameterize it with the functions h, z, z bar, some other matrix. And this four-point function I will call g prime, the components. Again, 1 minus z, 1 minus z bar. It turns out that there are three equations, only linear independent equations here, and four linearly independent equations here. So in total, seven. What we can do now is to study these equations using the standard method from the original work by Taylor expanding these functions around Taylor expanding. Around the crossing symmetric point z equals to z bar equals to 1/2. There are several subtleties. For instance, these objects have kinematic singularities. Also, one should figure out the behavior of this function under z and z bar permutation. But this is done very nicely in the conform frame. I will not, however, go into the details of these subtleties. Now, the final thing which I'll discuss in the technical setup is how to express this function in terms of the OP coefficients and conformal blocks. I remind you that a generic four-point function of four spinning operators, three or four, in the S channel can be written as follows. We, roughly speaking, we inject a pair of operators O Digger, and we split this four-point function into three-point functions in the following way. We have O1, O2, O, some operation, which we'll call cross, O3, O4. So this operation cross is basically an injection of a two-point function of shadow operators, and then conformally pairing them twice here and here. We can then decompose these three-point functions into tensor structures. This label here will specify that it's a tensor structure now. And the OPE coefficients will be placed here. OPE 1 to O, OPE O Digger 3, 4. I have to sum over AB, all the tensor structures, and all possible operators O. So this object I'll refer to as conformal block, which depends on all the external points 1, 2, 3, 4, and on the spin representation and scaling dimension of the operator O exchanged. Okay. This is conformal block. The bootstrap literature is often also denoted as the conformal partial wave. So now if we take a look at our correlator, which we want to study, let's see what OPEs enter, or equivalently, what three-point functions enter in this decomposition. First, we have psi Digger, psi, some operator O. These are charged objects, but the total charge is zero, so this must be a neutral operator under the global U1. And I'll refer to these three-point functions, or equivalently the OP channels, as the neutral channel. Another configuration is here when I have to take an OP of psi psi. These guys are charged, so this operator must be charged to have a total zero charge of the three-point function. I'll refer to it, I put the label C to refer to it, and I'll call it a charged channel. Let's now look at what spin representations can appear in these three-point functions. The statement is the following, that spins can be only of three types. LL, LL plus 2, and L plus 2L. So the first entry, LL, is the traceless, usual traceless symmetric operators. And the other two, I'll refer to them collectively as non-traceless symmetric, NTS. Now, the last thing to say that these four, these conformal blocks can be obtained from the seeds, or from the seed blocks, by means of differential operators. These differential operators, they are known. They also can be nicely constructed using weight shifting operators. However, the knowledge of the algebraic form of these guys does not help us in this situation, because it turns out it's very hard to approximate them. And that's why I will talk separately in the next section how to efficiently approximate these objects. And yeah, now it's the last point of this technical setup. If we take a look at the four-point function very concretely in the S channel. So the contribution of OPE coefficients which will enter in this decomposition in the S channel will have the following form, lambda of the three-point function psi Digger psi O, 0. Then O, 0, Digger, psi B, and the conformal block. Using, again, the CPT invariants, one can show, and playing with this three-point function, one can show that actually this OP coefficient equals to the complex conjugate of this one, psi dagger, psi O, B. So in the end, what we get here is the matrix of the form lambda, lambda star B. And this matrix is semi-positive, definite by construction. So this is the crucial property which allows us to use the standard bootstrap technique when we apply a functional on G and look for some function which is positive here, and the quantity in front is positive. Its Hermitian you will see, for instance, in our case, explicitly, when you have, for instance, a 2x2 matrix, that the eigenvalue 1 is 0 and 1 is positive. Just brute force for this case.
Maybe I should talk in the microphone. So I also have a question about the Lorentz representations that appear in the OPE. So these types, they both, all of them can appear in either channel. You have two different channels, the neutral and the charge channel?
Yes, they appear in both channels.
Okay, and then
but there are selection rules in a sense. Here, there's these fermions are to commute and they are identical, so they pose some constraints. For instance, for some odd or even tensor structures, they basically disappear, decouple.
And the non traceless symmetric guys are exchanged under CPT, right? The two types.
So, like in this channel, in the neutral channel, these two guys are related. They are forced to have the same scaling dimension. But in the charged, they are literally two different objects, independent ones. So, all these manipulations can be systematically done using the CFT4D package, which allows you to construct three-point tensor structures and find all the differential operators and apply them in the embedding formalism. Also, it allows you to work in the conformal frame for the four-point functions, etc. So any similar setup can be done straightforwardly using this package. So let's move now to the third section, rational approximation of conformal blocks. So what we would like to have for numerics is the following. Having a conformal block and its derivatives in Z and Z bar at the crossing symmetric point Z equals to Z bar equals to 1/2. Oops. What we know that this object can be written in the following form, where in the numerator we have some polynomial of delta, where delta is the scaling dimension of the exchange operator in the four-point function, divided polynomial of delta. And this is the approximate relation. We would like that. Analytic expressions do not allow us to find this approximation in a nice way, in a systematic way. So what we do is the following. We came up with the following procedure. First of all, we express the conformal blocks of z and z bar, and their derivatives. I'll collectively denote all these derivatives by delta. They can be written as a sum of the seed blocks and their derivatives. So the seed blocks, they are in four dimensions, they're parameterized or labeled by an integer parameter p, where p is defined as the difference between L and L bar in two integers. So in four dimensions, we have blocks, seed blocks corresponding to zero, p0, p1, 2, etc. And these guys are the famous one of Dolan and Osborne. So now, if we have the expression in terms of the seed blocks, we go to the second step. And using the weight shifting operators, it was shown that a seed block with P can be expressed as sum of derivatives of the seed blocks with P minus 1. And of course, you can take derivatives of this equation. So basically, starting from using this recursion relation of this form, one can start with the Dolan and Osborne block and build up all the seeds required. But this relation is quite complicated. Written in full glory for generic Z, Z bar, and components, it's a mess. I mean, it's a complicated object. And if you start plugging it recursively, even modern computers run out of memory already at the second step. So you cannot just do it brute force. So the way out of it is simple. Since we don't need the full expression, let's work only with rational approximations. So what we do is we start with the seed block, with the Dolan-Osborne seed block and its derivatives, at the crossing symmetric point. And there are various ways, efficient ways, how to approximate this object in terms of, in terms of a rational form, write it in terms of as a rational form. Now you can plug this expression into the recursion relation and build the rational approximation of the H1 block at the crossing symmetric point. Then you go on until you get, and these steps are very fast, until you get your desired seed block of some desired value of p, and then you get the rational approximation of the full block at the crossing symmetric point, z equals to.
So what happens when you are done with it? Do you save this in some huge cluster that then anyone can go and just extend? Because this you only need to do once, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So you choose the desired parameters. We pre-compute them once. This procedure is fast. It takes, like, even on the personal computer, well, on the PC, like 2 days to pre-compute all the tables with
But this is pre-computed with any external deltas, any internal deltas, and any... What is fixed when pre-computing this
test? So what is known, what is implemented, for instance, in the CFT4D package is this generic relation, which is for completely generic values of ZZ bar, deltas, etc. And then the code which does it approximately, it's for now it's private. But we just run it and pre-compute the final numbers and save it them.
But fixing the external dimensions, or
yes,
letting,
we have to discretize the external dimension. Otherwise, they enter in a non-polynomial form here, so we have to fix them.
Okay, thank you.
But in fact, they enter in a very simple form. You don't have to pre-compute tables for them. We found a way. We can talk about it later about the technicality. There is one last thing to say about this rational approximation, because this is not the end. There is the fourth step. The approximation using this procedure you get of the conformal block. It has spurious poles. So I'll write one spurious pole explicitly here. And sometimes they are above the unitarity bound. So they are really not allowed by representation theory. Sometimes they are below the unitarity bound, but they shouldn't be there. The reason for that is during all this technique, we get sometimes zeros in the numerator. And if the procedure was done correctly, this spurious pole should be cancelled by zero in the numerator. But since the equation is approximate, it can be done only approximately. So in practice, we have to manually, when we get these expressions, we have to manually look and for poles which appear and cancel them. So what we are planning to do to automatize this procedure, make it public, we'll need to construct a list of all the poles allowed by representation theory and write a little algorithm which will do it automatically, detect wrong poles and remove them, or divide the numerator by them. So I hope we'll do it at some point.
It's not that these blocks are
sure. Rational, I mean, so. This one.
Yeah.
Delta, sure. But yeah. We strip it off.
Sure, but so as not to confuse.
Yes. Everything we can strip off, and we do it. Absolutely. Thank you. So, let me show you the bounds then. Would you please put the slides online? Let's see if it works. Yeah. I'm sorry, can we put the slides on the screen? Yeah, perfect. So I'll start. Now, what kind of, I forgot to say before I address the slides. Now, I'll present the numerical status, what kind of bounds we can make. If you want, you can return back for a minute. Sorry for that. So first, we can put bounds on scaling dimensions. So given a channel, so in our case it's neutral or charged, and the spin representation of the exchange operators, so there's an infinite number of such operators, primary operators, and I will label their scaling dimensions as delta, delta prime, delta 2 prime, in the increasing order. So what we can do, we can ask the question, how big, for instance, the very first operator in such a representation, spin representation, and the channel can be before our setup violates crossing equations. Okay, so this is the standard bound. Then what we can also ask, we can ask bounds on central charges. In this case, CJ and CT. And the third type of bounds we can do or produce are the bounds on fermion or PE coefficients. In what follows, I will show you only this type of bounds. If someone is interested, I'll be happy to talk about the others after the talk. So now, please put the slides. We'll start with a neutral channel. And here's the bound on the scalar neutral operator. So on the vertical axis, you have the scaling dimension of the exchange scalar. And on the horizontal axis, you have the scaling dimension of the Weyl fermion, of the external operator. What? No, we assume only U1 global symmetry here. We assume only a U1 global symmetry. U1 in this setup. And the dashed line, so the blue is the allowed region of parameter space, and the dashed line is the generalized fermion generalized free field theory line, which must be in the allowed region. So the bound is very smooth, no kinks, unfortunately. So next plots. So in the neutral channel, you have spin 1 and spin 2 conserved operators. So they are fixed at dimension 3 and 4, respectively. So the upper two slides, they bound the second spin 1 and the second spin 2 operator after the conserved one, since the first one is the first ones are fixed. OK, smooth bounds. And starting from spin 3 and 4, these are lower two diagrams. We have a bound which starts very closely to the GFT line, and then it slowly deviates. This behavior that the bound follows the GFT line is generic, and it persists for spin 5, etc. Now I'll show you the first plot of the non-traced symmetric operator ever done. Here it is. So you can see on the vertical axis you have 1,3 representation. And we don't plot as the scaling dimension of 3,1 representation because it's exactly the same as I was telling to Balt. Now you see this weird, extremely weird feature, the jump. The bound starts nicely, smooth, but then as soon as it hits an integer value, which is 6 in this case, it jumps up. Here it is. And the same thing happens, for instance, for the representation 2,4. Again, the same jump, and again, it happens at the integer value, which is 7 in this case. Since we were looking for kinks, it's very tempting to say that there is a CFT living on top of this jump. However, the nature that the jump occurs at the integer value causes for some other reasoning. Maybe there's an effect for that. So let's go on. Yeah. Yeah, we did. I don't know. I cannot tell precisely, but yeah, it changes a bit. But we couldn't see any specific pattern. Yeah. I can show you the plots later if you're interested, but you will see it's non-physical, the jump. Spoiler alert. So now let's move to the charge channel. This is now the scalar operator in the charge channel, the same type of the plot, jump at dimension 4. And these are plots for spin 1 and spin 2 in the charge channel, the jumps at 5 and 6, respectively. And finally, to conclude these things, let me show you non-traceless symmetric operators in the charge channel, which are now different, 1,3 to the left and 3,1 to the right. No, you will see now. I'll talk about it in a second. What we can, if you look at the plot, we can deduce from this Fino data that the dimension of the jump, when the jump happens for the L, for the operator in the L with the spin L and L bar, it's always 4 plus L plus L bar over 2. That is easy to see, if it happens. And now I'll show you, just to convince ourselves that these jumps are not some fake effect of the numerics. Well, that they really persist. So this is the zoom on the scalar, charged scalar operator. And you see on top there are lambda, is the number of derivatives in the bootstrap equations we take. And we rebuild the same plot for 14 up to 26 derivatives. What you can observe, the bound becomes stronger in the beginning. And so the position of the jump moves, but it always happens when it reaches 4. And also the bound, the jump, at least by eye, it converges to some finite value, so it does not disappear at infinite precision. Okay. So thank you for the slides. Now we can come back and try. I'll now try to explain what happens to them. What is the effect of this jump? So the crucial observation is the following. Let me first write the unitarity bound in four dimensions. It is 2 plus L bar over 2. And the operators which satisfy the unitarity bound are free. Or conserved. The crucial observation is the following. If you take an operator O with a spin L plus 1, L bar plus 1, with at the unitarity bound for this particular spin, it must be conserved. So there is always a differential operator for a particular representation. And it is 0. However, this object forms itself a primer operator, which has the following scaling dimensions. First of all, it has spin by one, less by 1 for a generic case. And the scaling dimension, delta unitarity, plus 1. So this, since it's a primary descendant, it must be null, so I'll refer to it as a null descendant. And I'll put tilde here to distinguish it. So you can see now that this value corresponds exactly to the value of the jump, delta jump, L bar. So there's one here, comes from here, and one comes from the spin. So it's clear that, for us it was clear that somehow the presence of these null descendants enter in the story in the numerics and do something. To see how, we can write a known fact that a conformal block for the, I have space. A conformal block for the operator with a spin L plus 1, L bar plus 1, approximately in the for the delta close to the delta unitary has a pole with a residue given by some number and by some other conformal block of the operator which has spin LL bar delta unitary plus 1. So now, our setup, numerical setup, is not sensitive to a rescaling of the OPE coefficients. So, using rescaling, we can basically drop all these factors and say that the conformal block of the L plus 1, L bar plus 1 representation at the unitarity, at delta unitarity, is equivalent to delta of some block L, L bar, delta unitarity, plus 1. So you see where I'm heading. So if I'm building a bound on some operator LL bar, in the setup we have apparently some operators with another spin L plus one with the, yeah, which can be confused. And before,
if I take a spin 2 block and I push it to the unitarity bound, I don't get a pole, I just get a stress tensor block.
Right, but we don't bound stress tensors, so it does never appears in our story.
So this discussion should be qualified a little bit. So you should say for certain spins this happens, and for other spins this does not, or?
Yes. So now the last point, why sometimes it happens, sometimes it's not. It's just we have to look at this conformal block and use my favorite definition, which is some O1, O2. And this is my null descendant cross theta O3, O4. So this is the just the definition of this block. Now, the three-point function here is nothing but the conservation operator acting on the third point, O1, O2, O. Sometimes it's automatically zero. The this is my tensor structure. Some A prime. If I take a tensor structure and apply a conservation equation, sometimes it's automatically zero. And this is, for instance, in the case of identical scale operators and trace asymmetric operator. It's automatically zero. So the residue here is zero. You don't have a pole. You don't have this equivalence. However, for most generic cases, this object is non-zero. And you don't have to go even to the spinning case. One can take different scalar operators already with different scale dimensions, and it won't vanish. So the pole will be there. So this explains the presence. Well, I didn't explain what happens to numerics, but you see that in some channels this happens, in some channels it does not. And here's the example. We'll study the last plot, which I showed you, which is the charged channel, with spin representation L, L bar equals to zero. If I write this equivalence relation, now it is J of operator O, 1, 1, at the unitarity bound is 3, is equivalent to the conformal blocks of some scalar operator 0, 0 with dimension 4. And I remind you that in the charged channel there are no conserved operators coming, so this spin 1 conserved operator is not the global current. This would be in the neutral channel, so it's all good. And now let me show you the schematically draw the plot we get. So this is the scaling dimension of the neutral operator. Here's this 4. And the bound goes like this. It hits 4, it jumps. Here's delta psi. So the following is happening. This bound, what we do here is that we assume the scaling dimension delta of the lowest operator in the spectrum, and then I have delta prime, the heavier operators. So I bound the lowest operator, and I have a consistent bound. However, when I cross 4, what I actually bound, the problem changes, because what I bound is, given an operator at the scaling dimension 4, because I always assume all spin 1 operators are present, and they effectively behave as the scalar operator with dimension 4. So given that there is an operator with dimension 4, what is the scaling dimension of the second operator in the spectrum, etc. And of course, given that you have something at 4, you can, yeah, the second operator can be very heavy. And this is the result for the jump, the reason for the jump. Excellent, that's the next point, the last point. It is clear how to test this method. If I put a small gap on the value of the spin 1 operator, so basically I require in the setup that there are no conserved spin 1 charge operators, there shouldn't be any equivalence like that, so the gap shouldn't happen. And I'll show you the plot now. Could you please, for the last time, put the slides on? Perfect. Here's the plot. Basically what we do here is to rebuild the bound on the, you see on the vertical axis, the bound on the scale operator in the charge channel. And, but on top of it, I require that for spin one operators, they start not from exactly 3, but 3 plus some gap. And these are values of the gap we try, 0, 0, 1, etc., up to 2. And we rebuild the plot and put all the details, well, all these plots together on the here. So you see, as soon as you start increasing the gap, the jump starts shrinking, becomes smooth, and for the big enough gaps, it becomes a smooth line. So. Now, what is the consequences of this this thing? First of all, in three dimensions, the authors of the fermion bootstrap got the same feature, and it was exactly for the scalar at position 3. So the reason for that, we know it's this fake primary effect. On top of it, it turned out that this effect also contaminates the study of the Ising, 3D Ising model. If you build a plot of delta sigma and delta sigma prime, there was a jump. However, that jump was a superposition of the physical theory and the fake primary effect, so it was very hard to see. And I don't show it here, but you can see in the paper. We show if we try to exclude this jump by imposing the gaps, what happens to that plot. Right. Well, because the numerics is not precise, in a sense. It's all approximate. Right. So you see, we have not explored the possibility, given a very small gap, if we increase the precision of our numerics, the amount of bootstrap equations and derivatives and spins, how it will behave. So I don't have an answer to the question. Given a very small gap, is there high enough precision to completely remove the jump? Because that was built with 16 derivatives precision. So let me conclude now, and then we can keep the discussion if someone is interested. So the next step, the obvious step for us would be to do four abelian currents. And in fact, it's the same order of magnitude difficulty as fermions, maybe a bit simple in a sense that there are no anti-commuting objects, which is a pain. One thing I didn't talk here is the completely omitted the section of fermion computation of the spectrum of the fermion GFT, generalized free field theory on mean field theory. So we have closed form expressions here for all the OPE coefficients, and that was crucial, first of all, to check our setup, and second, to check all the approximations of the conformal blocks. So if someone is interested, I can give more details after the talk. Well, thank you very much for your attention.
Any more questions?
Okay, I guess the point here is that if the jump is physical, it will be insensitive to the gap, the spin one gap you add, right?
Could you repeat, please?
I want to understand. If the jump is corresponding to a physical theory, like the Eisen model, then it would be insensitive to how to the gap that you are adding in the spin one channel, right?
You're saying if the jump corresponds to a physical theory?
Yes.
What is interesting to
it would be insensitive to the gap.
Insensitive. In a sense, yes. If that theory does not have some operator very close to the unitarity bound of spin one operator. Okay. That can happen. I don't know. Yeah, that would be a difficult case. But yes. Generically, yes.
Any more questions? Artem seeing. If not, then let's thank Dennis again for a very nice talk.